Welcome to Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin Public Television original production, adapted for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Comfort. These stories were recorded in the natural settings of the regions that Native people have called home for centuries. Tribal members share their challenges, triumphs, and time-honored traditions that have shaped their vibrant communities across generations. Today, we hear the histories of the Potawatomi and Ojibwe nations. On the shores of Devil's Lake, tribal elders share the oral tradition of the Potawatomi people. At a time when their language and customs are in danger of extinction, find out what these elders are doing to preserve their culture for generations to come. And then, the legacy of the Ojibwe people, including the prophecy that led the Ojibwe from the East Coast to Wisconsin and told of what they would find. Potawatomi history and Ojibwe history coming up after the news. Welcome to Tribal Histories. First, we join Mike Alloway Sr. at the Forest County Potawatomi Cultural Center.
I'd like to say welcome. I wanted to share a little bit of information about the center here, why it exists. I'm hoping that we can get more people to start learning. That's one of the things we see here in our community is a lot of people are not wanting to learn their language. You know, I really hate to say that, but our language is endangered. We're forgetting who we are. Here at the museum, school groups come here, and that's something I always try to convey, is that real story. Because today in America, schools aren't really teaching about our history. They're not talking about treaties that were broken with the tribes. They don't talk about the boarding schools, how our ancestors were put in these places, beaten for talking their language. They're not talking about removal, that Potawatomi Trail of Death. It's sad for me to talk about that. It's sad for me to share that. I'm hoping we can get more young people involved. You know, this is the real story about our people. This is what this building is all about, is telling that story.
At Devil's Lake, elders Jim Thunder and Mike Alloway Sr. share the oral tradition of the Forest County Potawatomi people.
Bonjour. Winsi and Dijinakaz, Maka Ondo Dam, Bodwe Wadmi and Dow, Stone Lake and Dojibia. My name is Mike Alloway, Sr.
My name is Jim Thunder. I'm a member of the Forest County Potawatomi, and right now, I do a lot of teaching of the language and other things as I'm asked to do. And talk about the history as it was told by my people. I think those of us that do that have all this responsibility. If somebody wants it, we're there. Try to be there. I thought at one point, by this time, I'd be actually retired and traveling. As you can see, I'm not.
Part of the stories that I've been told was that at one time, the Potawatomis, Ojibwe, and Ottawa, we were all one large tribe that split up in the 16th century near the Straits of the Mackinac. These old stories were passed down to me from our elders, and according to them, each tribe, when they came to be, were given tasks. The Potawatomis were to be the keepers of the fire, Bodwe. That's where our name originated from, Bodewadmi, Potawatomi. And the Ojibwe were given that task of keepers of the faith. In fact, the word Ojibwe, as we know it, refers to a term known as G-bomb, which is the spirit of you and I at the present living. The term Ottawa originally meant dawa, to sell something or to trade something. So they were to be the people that kept the trade routes alive among the Anishinaabek, which we refer to ourselves as the original people. All of our language is pretty close, but there are some differences.
Banashi.
If you're raised up speaking like I do, you can understand a lot of it, most of it. I never had to really try to learn it or anything. I just understand it. It's, even if I've never heard it, I know what they're talking about. And our ceremonies pretty much remained the same, except Odawa a little bit more removed than we were because they were more dominated by the white people and the Ojibwa to a certain extent. They're a separate entity, but they still had the alliance. They called it Three Fires. As long as they're maintaining their individual fires, were still together.
Now, it is said that when we split up in Sault Ste. Marie, the Ojibwe traveled westward to Madeline Island, and today much of them reside in that general area. The Odawa pretty much stayed near the Straits and are now located up in Upper Michigan. Now the Potawatomi went further southward into Lower Michigan, parts of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And a lot of those towns that are located down in southern Wisconsin bear the names of what were once Potawatomi villages, Waukesha. In our language, that refers to a fox, which is Waukwijia. Wauwatosa is another one. That's Wauwatasi, meaning firefly. A little further south is what we now know as the city of Mukwonago. Muk meaning beaver den. So there's a lot of history of our people along the western shores of Lake Michigan, all the way up towards Washington Island. At one time, that was called Potawatomi Island. According to some of our elders, you know, they still go up there and collect medicines up there. But our history seems to be difficult to talk about at times because of the removals that were made back then. 1837, I believe, when a lot of tribes were being moved westward. Some moved into Canada. They kept going northward. And during that removal too, it is said that some Potawatomis went southward. They kept going south, and today they live among the Mexican Kickapoo Indians.
The Trail of Death. My great-grandfather was on that march. And as they were being forced out by the government, the removal policy, Andrew Jackson, somewhere along the line, they escaped, several of them, and my great-grandfather among them. And they joined up with a group of Kickapoo who were fleeing to Mexico. So they fled to Mexico and lived in Mexico. My grandfather was born there. After several years, U.S. Army sent soldiers into interior Mexico to go round up the Potawatomi because they had escaped. And on their first night back after they crossed the Rio Grande back into the States in Texas, my grandfather and them escaped again, a bunch of them, because the soldiers were busy partying. So I think they let their horses loose and fled. And my grandfather talks about playing up in probably the only tree in Texas, and soldiers rode up, an officer and a non-com. And all the able-bodied men were out hunting. Left the old man there to take care of the camp. So they shot the old man. Well, one of the ladies happened to have, a couple of them had skillets in their hands and knocked their soldiers off their horses. And they really did a number on them. So they had to bury them. They turned their horses loose. They couldn't keep them because of the horseshoes. Then they just had to flee right there. Grandfather, he was a little boy by this time. He talks about, you know, traveling by night. He kept pretty still during the day. Made their way to Kansas. And my grandfather, a young man, when he came from Kansas back to Wisconsin, a lot of them made their way up to the Sheboygan area that also escaped from the removal. So as the soldiers got closer, they just fled deeper into the woods from Sheboygan, and they finally moved up into Forest County there. Probably one of the, there were already Potawatomi living all over here. Just nobody knew where they were because everybody was in hiding because we fought the soldiers.
Around in the late 1800s, a gentleman by the name of Eric Morstead, who was a Lutheran missionary, learned that there were Potawatomis in northern Wisconsin that were living here and there. And he decided to help the Potawatomis through the Homestead Act. With that, he also worked with other attorneys to secure monies from the treaty at Chicago. A lot of that money was used to purchase lands up here in Forest County. And so we started to organize after the Indian Reorganization Act in 1934. And we officially became the Forest County Potawatomi in 1937.
Where we were raised on the upstream from my grandfather's homestead, my dad had put a log house up there. And then later on, more children came, he added a shanty to one end of it. Is a kitchen and a dining area. And we all slept in the log house. They preferred the log houses because they were much warmer. When the government first came and built these government homes, frame houses, they almost froze. So a lot of them moved back to these log houses during the winter. One old man they talk about, he lived in a hogan all his life. And the people in nearby town scraped up some lumber, built him a house. Then he had a nice barn.
The total population here of the Forest County Potawatomi, I believe, is pretty close to around 1,400. maybe a little bit more, but they say we're the smallest of all the 8 recognized bands of the Potawatomi Nation. A lot of the bands today kind of look at us as that band that has retained a lot of the traditions, being that we were the ones that hid from the removal process. A lot of our elderly today are being called upon by the other bands to assist with their language instruction. And so what we do is, like any other person would do, we try to help them as much as we can because, you know, according to a lot of our elders, there are probably, right now in this day and age, in this band, probably about 5 fluent speakers left of the Potawatomi language.
Without our language, we cease to be Indian.
Aptanev Jesus.
I spend a lot of time teaching language. Pride comes in the old ways that are being ignored. The respect for each other, our children. You know, in the white culture, you hear people, they teach their children, respect your parents. With us, it's respect your children.
We pass that language down to our younger generation so that they can carry that on. The Potawatomi language is the very definition of a people. It is the core. When Europeans came across the ocean, they encountered a unique people that had their ways of pretty much governing themselves, you know, through clans, through their language. And so that language is very sacred to our people. If it dies off, it is the end of the Potawatomi. Because when you're not using your language, you don't know anything about yourself. You don't know anything about your culture. You're outside of it.
My mother did not speak English. My dad only spoke enough to get by. He didn't care to improve it. It wasn't his language. My uncles, all my aunts never spoke. When we were visited, we had to use the language, particularly if we talked to the elders, because they didn't understand English. I would say something to my mother in English. She'd tell me, you have to talk Indian. That is not your language. A lot of things getting in the way nowadays, even for us. In the ceremonies, we try to keep alive. Again, that's part of being Potawatomi. The ceremonies. And the biggest part is that listening so you can learn.
With the addition of the museum, which was built around 1998, it provided a means for our community to kind of get together more, a place where a lot of people can come together and learn about the old crafts that were back in the day, you know. We have worked with several people to bring black ash basket making back into the community, and we've had various classes there on flute making, working with copper, bead working techniques.
There's a lot of things that we have lost. The great bulrush. I've seen those mats and the bags they made out of. My mother, she said they cut it with a scythe, laid it out on the shore to turn color to yellow. Then they were able to pound it and separate the fibers that they used to make these mats and bags. She said it was a long time ago that she remembers doing that. But I didn't quite ask her what the process was into doing this. And then there's another one called moose wood. It's also called leather wood. that you can, it's really strong. You can take a little piece like that, you'll never be able to break it by then. I've showed some people that, my people that here, they were unaware of it. But this is what we learned because of living way back out in the sticks.
In every family there are stories, you know. And all of those stories are meant to be shared. Last year we had hosted wintertime stories here. Some of the general stories can be told right now, but some of the sacred stories are usually told in the wintertime because everything is dormant. Our grandmother Earth, Kokmiskinan, we say, is sleeping. And so some of them sacred stories are told during the moon of the big bear, Chemkogesis, or February, Mkogesis. And we had a lot of our elders come in and talk about those in the language. And one of the unique things is that after the story in Potawatomi, they shared it in English. It gave those people in attendance that opportunity to actually think about what they were talking about. So that cultural center and museum, that is an avenue today for our community members to kind of get back. It creates also that ability for not only our tribal members, but that place where local people are given that chance to learn more about our history, because I think in the past, there's been so much controversy and racism that we had to live through. I remember back as a child attending a local school here in Crandon that it was very difficult. You know, there was absolutely no understanding or no knowledge of our history or anything like that. The impact of Indian gaming created a better life for a lot of tribal members. I know that there are things in the past that we wish we could have done, and now we're able to do it. You know, we have a natural resources department. They're actually monitoring our wolf population within the reservation boundaries. We have them also, you know, monitoring these waters here and ensuring that, you know, this is going to be available for the next generation.
Just when you start thinking that it's all lost, then you get people who are really interested in a lot of these things. Ceremonies, our language. My mother told me that once we lose a language, we cease to be Anishinaabe, which is Indian. And then she said, the Creator looks down here when we do a ceremony to hear us speak our language. When he no longer hears that language or see moccasin tracks, then he will think about ending the world again.
Our elders are doing what they can to ensure that, you know, what they leave is going to be picked up by some of our younger generation. Get back to teaching the history, the culture of our people, focus on a lot of the old ceremonies. And our belief why the Potawatomi were given that task of keeping that fire was that a lot of the ceremonies include that sacred fire that's built. Some of the old people, I heard them talk about that spirit that's within that fire there. And they refer to that spirit as Shkodanasi, the fire spirit. One who tends a fire is known as Bodawel Nene. And that's always been within our families that have carried on that tradition among our people.
And the social powers you hear advertised all over. People with their moccasins are still making moccasin tracks. So that has a purpose. That's what my mother told me when I asked her why they were doing that. So I never seen that done when I was growing up. It was all ceremonial. She told me it has a purpose now, because that's when the young people and everybody wear their moms and dancing around, and the crater looks down. Well, they're still down there.
Potawatomi History was funded in part by Irene Danielle Kress, the EVU Foundation, a charitable arm of the Capital Times, Ron and Patty Anderson, the Wisconsin History Fund, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Friends of Wisconsin Public Television.
You're listening to Tribal Histories. The storytellers you just heard were Jim Thunder and Mike Alloway Sr. from the Forest County Potawatomi community. Next, Eddie Benton Benet with the history of the Ojibwe people.
Tradition within a culture is the means by which information, cultural traditions, social expectations are transmitted from one generation to another through song, through story, orally. Oral tradition tells us who we are and what is ours, and it also explains to us our origin. We embrace oral tradition not so much because it is a repository of fact, but that it seems to answer those questions that have to do about truth. It is time immemorial, and whether we have the correct times and dates and names is secondary. It's the felt truth of the story.
My real name is Badwewenung. That name is my spiritual name. I'm also known as Eddie Benton Benet. And that's the name you'll find on all my vital statistics papers. I don't have a birth certificate, so you won't find that. But on all the records in school, driver's license, military record, that's the name you'll find. But my real name is who I really am. The Ojibwe word definition of Badwewenung is related to the Thunderbird spirit. And so in that relationship, then a person bearing that name is also known as a messenger, a teacher in that respect. So that's who I really am. The history of my people, the Ojibwe-speaking Anishinaabe, and all of the indigenous people of this part of the world, our history goes back many thousands of years. Our oral history would put us at the moment of creation. And the creation story indicates that the Creator, the one Creator, placed His children, the Anishinaabe people, on the earth, on this part of the earth, which means that we have absolutely no belief or lend any credibility to the Bering Straits idea. But for people who are comfortable with that, we'll not argue with that. But we know. We know, and this is what I teach my children, my grandchildren, and soon my great-grandchildren, and all the people that I come in contact with, that the true history of the original people of this part of the world has never been written. It's been written about but the history, the true history of our people, is recorded in our genetic memories and is acted out via our songs, our stories, our rituals, and via our original religion, which for the Ojibwe people is the lodge, the Madewin lodge. In the lodge and within the lodge is kept the original teachings. Not available in print, not available via the print media in any respect. And it's only, it's key, the key to it is the language. So without the language, a person wanting to delve into that history, whether for personal or spiritual reasons, without the language, it's a very, you're a very, very handicapped person in that respect. I'm very fortunate, in fact, that I was born to a family, to families who did not allow the English languages to be spoken in their homes. And I grew up in that environment. I did not begin to hear the English language until about age 7. And then at that age, very, very minimally. I was not permitted to go to school until age 9. And the reason was that I sit here now at 62 years of age, and English is my second language. I speak my original language, the natural language of the Anishinaabe people, which is Ojibwe. And along with that background, then of course I heard only Ojibwe history. I was taught Ojibwe values, the rituals, the songs, the philosophy, the theology. And I was raised in that manner. I was first introduced to fasting at age 5. And every second year after that, I was made to fast. And in time, began to understand what that was all about and what that's for. Fasting, not today, people like to use the term vision, questing. But fasting is a learning process, is a learning process of meditation, of prayer, of thought, and analysis. And the Ojibwe people had developed a very keen educational system within their own culture and within their own environment. A lot of people were forced to abandon that, of course, as we got civilized. But therein lies then the absence of our history. What has replaced it but Euro-American history? Very heavy emphasis on the European peoples and their history. Well, that's what we were force-fed. And then in that force-feeding, of course, we were forced to abandon our own history. And trying to replace that with somebody else's values and somebody else's history leads to largely people who have no roots, who have no bearing, and being lost in two different worlds, losing your own culture, losing your own identity, and then not being accepted in the dominant society because you are Indian. It sets up a losing situation, and it's terrible. And Indian people are in a very tough situation. We live in a modern, industrial, contemporary society that's racing along towards its own destruction. As an ethnic group, we have the shortest lifespan of anybody in this country. Prior to 1492, we were a healthy, very wealthy nation. We didn't have Federal Reserve Bank, but we were a very wealthy nation. When you are healthy in spirit and you're healthy in body, you are wealthy. And when I say wealthy, I don't mean the laying up of riches or the accumulation of material things, but we were a very wealthy nation. The people that are now called traditional people, if you look at them as the Indian population, you'll find an absence of alcoholism, you find an absence of suicide, you find an absence of drug abuse, you find an absence of all these contemporary behaviors, negative contemporary behaviors. So, you know, when we think about history, we think about how we were prior to 1492. And you start off by saying, the Creator placed us here on this part of the world. This is our homeland. This is our roots. The earth is the mother of all living things. That's a starting point. And you have to knock out and get rid of some racist and stereotypical kinds of things. One of those being the idea that it's always been thrown around that Indian people worship a lot of gods. That is totally false. That's one of the greatest lies that were ever told by the civilizers. And it's come, and it has come down even to this age. There's young non-Indian kids in school today who believe those very same things that their grandmothers and grandfathers passed on to them. So, you know, it's generational. And so the problems are generational. But when we take a look at our own history and say that we have a history on this continent that goes back 50,000 years plus, you're looking at a long period of time. And we weren't running around these woods here naked and not knowing what to eat and what made us well. We knew that very well. And the idea about the history of Wisconsin. We, the Ojibwe people, were given seven major prophecies. Seven major prophecies probably about 500 years prior to 1492. One of those prophecies was the coming of a light-skinned race to this land. At that time, around 850 AD, 900, we as a nation were still principally located on the eastern seaboard, around the mouth of the St. Lawrence River. And somewhere around that same period of time, we were part of a large, large spiritual confederacy. The Algonquin nations had a spiritual confederacy. And through that confederacy, we had trading relationships with many other nations, the Seneca, the Iroquois peoples. In our oral history, it stated very clearly that the Medewin Lodge stood side by side with the Longhouse, and neither the Longhouse nor the Medewin Lodge incurred into the other, but that there was mutual respect, as the teaching is about respect, and which is a key. We have always respected other people's beliefs and other people's way of life, and perhaps too much. Perhaps we respect it too much because, with that natural respect and with that value, we became easy marks. You know, we became easy prey. And to the people that were coming into this part of the world from across the ocean needing land, we said, there's plenty for everybody. How much do you need, you know? And we can see the result. Today, I sit on a little patch of ground here that my grandfathers and grandmothers walked upon and picked berries. And it's only by sheer might and sheer will that I've saved this little piece of our original homeland. And I'm going to save it, and I'm going to keep it in such a way that it's going to be in our hands for seven generations from now. And that's the way that we look at everything. At what we do during our lifetimes has to reflect seven generations into the future. When you think about that, and when you really, really think about that, the dominant society has no such concept. They have no such value. And I wonder, we have been together 500 and some years, and we still haven't learned enough about each other. I don't think white society knows any more about us today than they did in 1492 or whenever it was they got here, and have never bothered. have never bothered to learn. Only assumptions have been made. Assumptions that we worship everything. Well, we do. We worship everything because everything is of the Creator. The spirit of the Creator is in these beautiful trees here. These beautiful trees are living beings. I can point out to you which one of those two trees are male and which one is a female. And it takes two of them to produce seeds that will produce more trees. But has any white people ever asked us how we can tell and what that means? No, because all those trees represent is board feet of lumber, which are marketable and dictated by Dow Jones. That's the sum total of interest to this beautiful land and to its resources. In these woods, as we look around anywhere here across the lake, in the swamps that we came by, there is medicine there that can heal cancer. There's medicine there that can heal many things. Has anybody ever asked us about it? No. Only if they want to patent it, only if they want to exploit it. We as a nation, we're still principally located on the eastern seaboard. And urging of the people to follow the setting sun, there was a prophecy of the finding of a sacred food. And it was described to us as food that grows on water. And coming here to this part of the world, to this part of the country, the abundance of wild rice was just absolutely amazing. Every lake and every river was just absolutely overflowing with wild rice, food growing on water. That's how the migration came to its end here. And where it started from, in the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, somewhere there was a great rock formation. Actually an island that was in the shape of a great turtle. And that turtle was faced in this direction. So that was the starting point, and the migration, you know, is well recorded. People know where we were. But when we came to the land of the food growing on water, we knew that we were somewhere close. So the actual westward movement of the migration stopped at what is now Duluth, Minnesota. And high up on what is now known as Spirit Mountain, on a given daybreak, on a beautiful daybreak, they looked down upon these beautiful waters, and there was a turtle-shaped island. And nobody knows this history either, but that's the real history of it. And that island was known as Manitou Island, Spirit Island, because that's what they were looking for. Then, of course, eventually we moved on to what is now known as Madeline Island. When the long coats, the missionaries, they were prophesied too, the ones with the big long black robes and the big black hats carrying a book, they were prophesied too. When they began to come this way, then this was after contact, of course, around 1580s, early 1600s. Madeline Island was the thriving spiritual center of the Ojibwe nation. That's where the sacred scrolls were taken. That's where the sacred water drum was taken. All the sacred articles that represented the migration. When it was known then that the black coats and missionaries were headed this way, there was another flurry of activity, because it was known what was going to take place, that eventually Madeline Island was going to be overrun, and that to stay there, to keep the sacred articles there, would be foolish. And so there was a mass exodus from Madeline Island. And at that time then, that's how these small bands, reservations, began to be established. It was directly from Madeline Island that my grandfathers and grandmothers came to this part of what is now known as Wisconsin. And then it's from here there was another dispersal of people and clans and families, the St. Croix people, the Mole Lake people, Lac du Flambeau people. So this was kind of a secondary dispersal center of the people. But it was always on that basis. So the exodus from Madeline Island preceded the arrival of the traders and the missionaries by quite a few generations, but they really did not know it. And there's still some people today who don't who don't know it. There's a great deal in our history that talks about Wisconsin. We knew these lands, we knew these rivers, we knew these lakes very, very well. When you couple today with the names of some of these places, for instance, Wisconsin River, that's really taken from what we named the river, Owiskasing River, the twisting, turning river. And in that description, it must have been a huge, beautiful, just an absolutely, oh God, it must have been so tremendous. It's mighty, just powerful. Ah, beautiful. And when you look around the state of Wisconsin, you see our place names in many places. And it indicates how well we knew and how, what we felt about the land. And the tall, absolutely magnificent pines that stood on these lands, or giants that had stood for centuries. And the people's tears and anguish and sadness when the civilizers came and cut them down. Those were heartbreaks that many, many people have still yet to recover from. But it was absolutely magnificent. You look at the history of Wisconsin, the recorded history of Wisconsin, and the size of those trees are just absolutely tremendous. And so this whole land was like that. It was fresh and teeming with game and animals, medicines, food, fruit of every description. There was no place you could be here in this part of the country and starve unless you wanted to, because there's food and medicine everywhere. So our story of Wisconsin, you know, takes many turns. It's a spirit. We had a spiritual connection to the land. Everywhere we look, we know that our grandmothers and grandfathers are buried. And there are key points where people do not know what's there. Because we've hidden a lot of things. And as a result of that, there's a lot of distortion in history. There's a lot of distortion in the way people write about us. We haven't taken great pains to correct some of those things, because some of those distortions actually conceal something. There are many beautiful sacred places here in this part of the world, this part of the North. So our relationship, 500 and some years, we've lived side by side. And I think America still has a lot to learn about us and from us. And I, for one, knowing what our true religion is, our teachings, living them to the best of my ability, know that someday our white brothers are gonna come. They're gonna ask, how can we live in peace? And I, for one, can articulate the message that was given to us generations and generations ago, even before the arrival of the light-skinned race, one of the prophecies was this, in very simple words. The prophet, the spirit that spoke to the people, said to the people, and that's us, the Anishinaabe people, said, "You shall know the truth of these things when these things shall come about." And you know what he described? Here's the words. In the language, it sounds like this: "In Guding, Ejiwebak, Oma King, Damanadad Nibe, Minoagigo, Angakashkaasin the Amwat." And in those words, the English interpretation is this: that you shall know the truth of these teachings and the truth of these prophecies when the time shall come that the rivers will run with poison and the fish become unfit to eat. Has that happened? You think it's untrue? It was prophesied. It was prophesied then too that in the time of the seventh fire, a new people would rise up. And when I first heard that, I thought perhaps it meant only Indian people. But I realize now that what was prophesied is that there's got to be a new people. Because the people that we're dealing with now are going to destroy the earth. And along with that destruction is going to be the destruction of all of us. And so there's got to be, and there is slowly rising a new people. A new people that will begin to appreciate each other for who they are, for their differences, for the differences in the way they look at things and the way that they think about things. And therein, to me, is the salvation of humanity. Otherwise, it ain't. Otherwise, we're gone. There ain't going to be no seventh generation for any of us. So our story, it's a very touching story. Very sad story in some respects. Yet it's beautiful too. It's beautiful and lasting, because in spite of the fact that the lumber companies came in here and cut it all down almost, we've still survived. These trees are never going to be cut down. The wind might take them down if the Creator sees fit to blow them down, but there's no lumber company ever going to take them down.
And they must all stop just like that, eh?
The Wisconsin Collection is a partnership of the Wisconsin Historical Society and Wisconsin Public Television.
This has been part 5 of Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin history project by Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Historical Society. It was produced and edited by Mick Dirks. The storytellers you heard this hour were Jim Thunder, Mike Alloway Sr., and Eddie Benton Binet. Sound design was by Tom Nounas and Kerman Eckes. Audio mix was by Kurt Sorensen. Music was by Eddie Benton Binet, Frank Montano, and Tom Nounas. Production assistance by Donna Crane. Adapted for radio by Jennifer Dargan, Tom Blaine, and Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Carol Larson. directors of production Kathy Beeson and James Steinbach.